The Katra Podcast Conversations for the Curious Essential Knowledge, Simplified, your gateway to essential ideas that matter most. This audio summary has been prepared with the help of a Katra AI. Welcome back, everyone. Today, we're doing a deep dive into something fundamental physics, but maybe not in the way you learned it in school.
Yeah, we're not really getting into the formulas.
Yeah, today. Definitely not. We're looking at the story behind the science, using J.L. Heilbronn's amazing work, The History of Physics, as our guide.
And this is, I think, so important because the way we usually hear it is like this straight line, right? Galileo, then Newton, then Einstein. Like, it was all planned out.
Right, this march of progress driven by isolated geniuses.
Exactly. Yeah. And Heilbronn just completely dismantles that idea. He argues it's, well, fundamentally flawed.
That's really the core question for us today. Not just what did we discover, you know, gravity, relativity, all that, but how and why did those discoveries happen then and there?
Mm-hmm. Why 17th century Europe for that big shift towards quantitative science? It wasn't just random.
It depended on specific people, specific institutions.
Funding, politics,
yeah.
Even war, as we'll see. Heilbronn shows it's all contingent. It could have gone differently.
Well, the idea is by the end of this, you'll see physics less as, I don't know, a set of abstract laws floating out there.
And more as this really rich, messy human story.
Yeah.
Deeply interwoven with culture and society.
Okay, so let's talk about the historian who gives us this viewpoint, J.L. Heilbronn. Who was he? What made his perspective so unique?
Well, John Lewis Heilbronn, he passed away recently in 2023, was, I mean, really one of the absolute top historians of science globally. Professor emeritus at UC Berkeley.
And what's really interesting is his background, right? He wasn't just a historian.
Exactly. That's the key thing. He was actually a trained physicist first. He understood the science, the math, the concepts from the inside. Then he moved into history.
So he could speak the language, so to speak, but chose to analyze it from a different angle.
Precisely. And his angle was very specific. He was an institutional historian.
Okay, what does that mean in practice?
It means instead of focusing only on the big ideas, the intellectual breakthroughs, he looked at the structures. The scaffolding, as you put it earlier.
Right.
The patronage systems, how universities were organized, the rise of scientific societies, later on government labs. He was interested in, you know, who paid the bills? Where did people actually do the science?
So less about the equation on the blackboard and more about who bought the chalk and built the lecture hall.
You got it. He saw science as embedded, deeply embedded, in specific cultural, political, even economic contexts, not some pure activity happening in a vacuum. His work is full of deep archival research showing how these structures enabled or sometimes limited discovery.
Okay, let's get into the book itself then, The History of Physics. It covers a huge sweep of time, right? From the ancient Greeks all the way to modern physics.
It really does. From physical, what the Greeks called natural philosophy, through the scientific revolution, the Enlightenment, the industrial age, and then bam, into quantum mechanics and what he calls big science.
And the main thread, the core argument running through all that.
It's that physics didn't just evolve on its own. It was constantly shaped by these outside forces, cultural, social, political, economic. Progress wasn't inevitable. It was contingent, historically contingent.
And a huge part of that story is this massive shift in thinking he calls the Great Transformation.
Yes. The move away from a qualitative view of nature, think Aristotle, asking why things happen, their purpose, their telos.
Like, why does a rock fall? Because it wants to reach its natural place, the center of the earth.
Exactly. Moving from that why to a quantitative mathematical mechanical description, asking how fast does the rock fall? Can we write an equation for it?
Focusing on prediction and measurement over final causes.
Right. And Heilbronn insists this wasn't destiny. It could have gone other ways if the circumstances, the institutions had been different.
So to really grasp that change, we need to start before the revolution, back in the medieval period. What did physics or physica look like then? And what about the church's role? We often hear about conflict there.
Yeah, the simple story is science versus religion. But Heilbronn shows it's much more nuanced. Actually, medieval Christian theology, particularly through the university system it fostered, provided the institutional home for rational inquiry.
Hmm, interesting. So the church actually preserved and housed the intellectual toolkit, even if the prevailing philosophy was still largely Aristotelian, based on the ancient Greeks.
Pretty much. And we shouldn't just dismiss that old system as wrong.
Mm.
Heilbronn makes a point about Ptolemaic cosmology, the Earth-centered model.
Right, the one Copernicus overturned.
Yes. But for 1,400 years, it worked remarkably well as a predictive tool. It was a sophisticated mathematical system for calculating planet positions. Its sheer usefulness kept it dominant for centuries.
That really shows how practical utility can keep an idea going, even if it's not, you know, ultimately true in our modern sense.
Absolutely. Which brings us nicely to the scientific revolution, where math really takes center stage. And Galileo is key here, but not just for his telescope.
You mentioned his maneuvering earlier. Tell us more.
Well, Heilbronn highlights Galileo's genius wasn't just in observation and math, but in politics and, frankly, rhetoric. Getting the Medici family, the powerful rulers in Florence, as his patrons, was crucial.
How so?
It allowed him to leave his university job. As a professor, he was kind of stuck teaching the old Aristotelian stuff. Patronage gave him the freedom, the resources, and the status to pursue his own research and publish his, well, revolutionary findings.
So the Medici funding basically bought his independence from the academic old guard. That's a brilliant point about context.
It really is. And then comes Newton, synthesizing mechanics in his Principia Mathematica, an absolute landmark. But even Newton's work needed the right institution to spread and stick.
And that was the Royal Society in London.
Yes. It provided something new, a mechanism for validation outside the universities.
Right.
They had committees for peer review, and critically, they published the Philosophical Transactions.
The first real scientific journal.
Basically, yeah. It created a system of trust and solved the huge problem of how you share and validate these super complex mathematical ideas across Europe. It built credibility. It was the engine of dissemination.
Okay, so institutions are evolving. Let's jump to the 19th century. Classical physics, thermodynamics, electricity, and magnetism. What's driving the bus now, according to Heilbronn?
Two big things, professionalization and industrialization. The practical needs of the Industrial Revolution were a massive driver.
Mm-hmm.
Think about the steam engine.
Yeah.
The urgent need to make steam engines more efficient directly pushed the development of thermodynamics, the laws of energy, entropy, statistical mechanics. It wasn't just theory trickling down. The practical problem forced the theory forward.
That's a fantastic example of that theory-practice link you mentioned. They feed each other.
Totally symbiotic. And this era also sees the rise of the modern research university, especially the German model. Physics becomes a formal profession. Dedicated labs, career paths.
Right, not just gentlemen scholars tinkering.
Exactly. And it culminates in James Clerk Maxwell unifying electricity, magnetism, and light with his famous equations. For a moment there, it looked like physics might actually be complete, a perfect deterministic clockwork universe.
And then came the 20th century. Relativity, quantum mechanics, shattering the clockwork. But Heilbronn points to another huge shift, institutionally speaking, around World War II.
Oh, absolutely. The Manhattan Project. That's the inflection point for what he terms big science.
Big science. What defines that?
Scale, mostly. Suddenly you have physics operating on an industrial scale. Huge teams, massive government funding, enormous equipment like particle accelerators, and this deep, often uncomfortable entanglement with military and state interests.
So the image of the lone scientist, the Michael Faraday in his basement lab, that's basically over.
Pretty much gone, yeah.
Yeah.
Replaced by the specialist, a cog in a giant hierarchical machine. After 1945, the physicist wasn't just an academic anymore. They became a public figure, a government advisor, part of these vast projects. The whole culture changed almost overnight.
Wow. Okay. This historical journey gives us so much to think about. Let's try and distill some of the key themes or messages Heilbronn wants us to take away.
I think the first big one is just the social context of knowledge. He hammers this home. What science discovers, or even looks for, is shaped by the society it's in. Beliefs, politics, economics, they influence the questions, the funding, the interpretation.
Which means thinking about science policy is never just about the technical stuff. You have to consider the social drivers, too.
Definitely. Then there's the symbiosis of theory and practice. We saw with the steam engine. It's not always pure theory leading to cool gadgets. Often, the need for a better gadget drives the theoretical breakthrough.
Yeah, so if you're deciding where to put research money today, you have to realize that funding applied research inevitably shapes the direction of pure science, too. They're linked.
Mm-hmm. Linked, exactly. A third one is the crucial role of the evolving institution. Physics needed different kinds of support structures at different times. Philosophical schools, then royal courts, then academies like the Royal Society, and now these huge government and industrial labs. The scaffolding is critical.
That makes you wonder, what are the key institutions enabling innovation in your field today? Is it universities, venture capital, government grants? online communities? It's a good question to ask.
It really is. Mm-hmm. And finally, maybe the mathematization of physics. Math became the language because it was so powerful for prediction and precision. But Heilbronn points out a consequence.
Which is?
This highly abstract mathematical language created a barrier. It professionalized the field, yes, but it also separated physicists from the broader public, maybe reducing that direct popular engagement over time.
That's a really interesting point. Heilbronn's writing sounds like it's full of these powerful summary statements. Are there any particular quotes that really capture his perspective?
Oh, definitely. He has a great way of boiling things down. Here's one about the core change. The scientific revolution was not so much a discovery of new facts as it was the invention of a new way of asking questions, exchanging the why of the philosophers for the how of the mathematicians.
Wow. Okay, that hits hard. It wasn't just finding new answers, it was changing the type of question being asked, shifting the goal from purpose to quantifiable description.
Exactly. And then there's his description of the modern physicist, post-WWII. After 1945, the physicists could no longer be just a solitary seeker of truth. Transform them into a public figure, a government advisor, and a member of vast industrial-scale teams.
That captures that whole shift to big science and the, well, the burden and complexity that came with the atomic age. The loss of innocence, perhaps?
Yeah, I think so. It nails the change in the profession's culture and its relationship with power.
So thinking about how we can use these insights, what are the real-life applications? For leaders or policymakers, the message seems clear.
Absolutely. Stop just looking for the next Einstein. Innovation comes from sustained investment in the ecosystem, the infrastructure, the networks, the collaborations. Build the right environment, and the breakthroughs are more likely to happen.
It's about nurturing the garden, not just trying to pick the prize flower.
Well put. And for all of us, just as individuals trying to understand the world, this history promotes intellectual humility, I think.
How so?
By showing that these worldviews that seemed totally complete and correct at the time Aristotle's physics, even Newton's, were eventually superseded. It makes you pause and think, okay, what assumptions are we making now that might seem really strange in 100 years?
That's a powerful tool for critical thinking. It encourages you to question the foundations of current knowledge.
And you can apply the Heilbronn method, sort of, to almost any field. If you want to understand why something succeeded or failed, a company, a project, an idea, don't just look at the key players' decisions. Look at the whole ecosystem.
The funding, the tech readiness, the cultural climate, the context. It's all about contextual thinking.
Exactly. Context is king.
So, wrapping things up, what's your main personal takeaway from diving into Heilbronn's perspective? What really stuck with you?
For me, it's really the power of that institutional narrative, the idea that Galileo needed the Medici, that his political skill in securing patronage was arguably as vital as his scientific insight. It just highlights how knowledge needs resources, it needs a structure, it needs, frankly, a bank account to really take root and flourish.
That's a great point. What resonated most with me was just the sheer, almost unbelievable shift in scale. Thinking about physics going from, you know, a small demonstration on a table in someone's drawing room in the 18th century,
right,
to something like the Large Hadron Collider today, a multi-billion dollar multinational project involving thousands of people. That transformation, driven by history, by war, by human ambition, it really drives home that science is, at its heart, a human story.
Couldn't agree more. Understanding the context really is the key to appreciating the science itself.
See you next time with another remarkable thinker, another powerful book, and another idea that has shaped our world. This audio summary is brought to you by Acotra Foundation.